This past week has been a rather emotional one, based on various circumstances. I mentioned in my sermon this past Sabbath about Louise Black being in the hospital. After the Sabbath, she declined to where she could just barely speak. And I went in about Tuesday, and I could just make out a bit of a whisper, and even then she was only speaking a couple of words at a time and had to struggle to do that. Come about Thursday, I had gone back in. I had checked in every day, and she picked up a little bit on Wednesday. There was just a little stronger voice, and it was like, wow, what's this? Because she hadn't eaten anything. And Thursday I went in, and Donna Kopke was coming out and had been up to the room and wasn't able to wake her, and she was sleeping so soundly Donna didn't want to just, you know, shake her to alertness at that point. And a couple of other ladies were heading up, so I just didn't stop on Thursday, and I couldn't get by yesterday till late. And so finally last night, about 7, 8 o'clock, whatever it was, finally I think I made it over to the hospital, and I checked at the desk as I went in and made sure the room was the same room. They hadn't moved her in the hospital, and the desk clerk said that she was still there in the same room, 318. And I walked into the room, and the bed was empty and made. And, you know, your heart just stops. And I said, well, there's no way. That's possible. Somebody would have said something. And I went to the nurse's station. They said, oh, no, she's doing quite well. They took her out today and put her in the nursing home. And I went down to the nursing home to visit her and had a long conversation with her. And she says, yeah, I'm going to put all my energy and strength into the therapy. I want to get up back on my feet again and try to get out of here and get back home. Well, we almost buried her on Tuesday. I mentioned in my sermon, you know, we sat and discussed the funeral and things that she felt were important in this life and her life. And then I watched her after that decline. And then to see the rally and the return and taking nutrition again and sitting up in bed and looking to therapy so she can strengthen her legs and get back out, it was, like you say, it was a bit of a roller coaster watching the process play out. When I was visiting Louise earlier in the week in the hospital, Michelle called me to tell me that Jean Gangnath had just been brought into the emergency room below in the same place. And I went down and spent some time down there with Jean and her family that were there with her at the hospital. And Jean had fallen in her home, was treated and released, and was then readmitted to the hospital. And as the announcement said, her kidneys had shut down. And it made it very, very hard. Eventually, as her condition declined, she was on a ventilator and in intensive care. And through further testing yesterday, they found that she had an intestinal problem as well that required immediate surgery to correct, and that's being done today. So Jean very much still needs our prayers, and Louise as well, and Kay for her vision and eyes to be able to carry on serving God in the way that she has been called. We need to keep all these ladies and their families in our prayers. You know, Lisa Fenchel and her family and others that we know in very personal ways. We are an older church, brethren, and we are facing some matters now in a greater way than we have before, and some of those are health issues. And frankly, some of those God called years and years ago. I've talked to some recently where there was a series of Bible studies that were held in Spokane, where it was held every night over a period of a week or two. And people from the area came in and began to attend. And many of these people, well, you know, they made friends right there at the studies, and then they continued on right into the church. And in that sense, they've spent much of their lives now serving God as part of His church. Some of our long-term members, having lived out their life as God called them to, are simply going to die. But we do need to remember that God is the one who grants us our years of service, and it's God who chooses whether to sustain us or not to intervene one more time. one of the nights, maybe it was even Tuesday, when I was with Louise, and she was in a lot of pain and very, very uncomfortable and struggling in the bed even because of her discomfort. And I commented to her, and I says, "I'm sorry that you hurt so much." And she says, "Christ suffered." And I thought, here she is in bed, in pain, and she's thinking the fact that Christ suffered for her, so it's not necessarily unusual that she would suffer at some point in her life as well. At that point in time, Louise was actually ready, if it was God's will, to die. And then, again, as I said, she started getting stronger. Apparently, God has more work for her yet to do. When we evaluate our lives, what is it that we come to value the most? What in our lives do we value the most? I think most of us would clearly say our calling. But what about the experiences that we've had, the circumstances we've walked through? Do we value only the good times, or do we not also value some of the bad? Looking back, do we not also value some of the bad? My mom has said so many times, she said, "I could write a book." And she's looking back at raising our children, us boys, and the circumstances that she faced in the family and what she went through. You know, many of the things that we will sit now with my mother and laugh about weren't that funny when they happened. There was a time we used to go fishing in Montana as children, and Dad would take us out, and it wasn't a whole lot of fun getting from our house to the fishing area because you had to sit real tight and real still, and you couldn't stick your feet up under the seat in front and poke him from below because he wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior. And so you couldn't punch and joke and slap each other in the back seat, so we had to sit there as good little soldiers. But we would get out to the fishing area, and then we could run and romp and just tear up and have such a grand time. My brother had a large yellow felt hat, orange to yellow felt hat, that he had collected a bunch of souvenirs on, and it looked, well, it looked precious to a child. My dad had a little different perspective on its appearance, and it had all these things dangling from it. And finally, in a course of frustration, as we were leaving that fishing hole for the last time of the year, my dad got mad at my brother, grabbed that felt hat, and tossed it into the bramble of bushes, and off we drove for the winter. Well, we were the first family back in there in the spring, and here's this old felt hat sitting just right where it had been tossed. And of course, my dad had had the whole winter to cool off, and so my brother just kind of waited his peace and kind of walked over the bush and snagged his hat back, and he wore it home, and Dad let it go. But we laugh about that in the family, how even you couldn't even ruin that felt hat by leaving it out all winter in the bushes outside. Us boys, we had a bit of a problem. Somehow or other, things kept turning up at home that my mom just didn't believe were ours, and they seemed to wander into the house in our pockets. And she finally got so tired of that process that she sewed up every pocket we owned. You couldn't carry a hanky, a nickel's worth of change. You couldn't put your hand or fingers in your coat or your pants or your shirt. She took every single pocket of everything we owned and sewed it tight shut. And that sat there for probably a month or so until our, well, actually, I don't know if our habits changed. I think we just got more careful about how we had to process those things we accumulated. But we laugh about that now. My mom jokes about how when she used to call herself Mrs. Dollar's Worth of Gas, because she would pull into the gas station with $1 and put a dollar in the tank, and that would hold until she put in the next dollar in the tank. And it was embarrassing to her at times to have this dollar only, although gas was cheaper then, but still. And so she would almost bitterly describe this when it was happening. Now, she'd pull into the gas station, and surely the attendants would say, "Well, here comes Miss Dollar's Worth of Gas." And now we laugh. It's funny. Those were times that we walked through, in some cases that were difficult and stressful. There is a measure of value in the trials that we walk up against and face. And that's why I believe my mom says that she could write a book because there was something she learned, and we all learned from walking through those things. Frankly, most of us probably could write a book just the same way. In the book of Hebrews, in chapter 11, there's a chapter here on faith and the trials that God's servants walked through and the lessons they learned and the conviction they developed in the process. And I want to read a couple of these verses, starting in verse 23. It says, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command, which was to put the boys to death. By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasure of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward." And so Moses was looking past the immediate problem and the trial to the benefit and the purpose of what he was called to do. "By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned." And so you see here a distinction being made that because Moses had faith in God, he was able to face trial and test, and God protected him, interceded for him, and those he opposed, or those who opposed him, were cut off. Back in verse 4, talks about Abel offering to God a more excellent sacrifice, Enoch being translated and not seeing death, in other words, being taken away, and God took him until the time that he died to another place. And verse 6, "But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." Our faith, brethren, is a work in process. God calls us and we begin to believe in him, but he literally allows us to walk through both good times and bad, and the bad are sometimes worth more than the good in the development of the character that we attain. And God would have us not to begrudge those times. It doesn't mean those times are fun, but that we would actually appreciate walking through even some of the bad times as well. Hebrews 12, verse number 1, "Therefore, we also, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily ensnare us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." And it's interesting the way this is now worded, "looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith." The author of our faith and the finisher of our faith. In other words, there's a process to build faith that Christ is going to finish that he called us to, "who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." God first loved us, we didn't first love him. God first called us, we didn't call him. And the faith that we have didn't just start on its own either. Christ is the author of our faith, but the finisher. Have you ever finished like furniture or something where you have to start out and you sand it all down and finer and finer and finer, and then you put a seal on it and then you rub that out? I've always liked oil and wax as a finish. And I've sat there sometimes when making a craft or something where you rub that out and you put some more on, you rub it out finer and finer and finer until it just absolutely polishes. It's an incredible process, but Christ describes here himself as the finisher of our faith, where he actually walks us through a series of steps so that we might attain the kind of faith that is pleasing to God. Ephesians 2 says, "By grace we have been saved through faith, and that not of ourselves. It is the gift of God. And so God actually is working in us to build faith, to have strength and courage and conviction. In that sense, we're a work in progress through good times and bad. And in fact, brethren, it takes both. At Challenger Camp, there's a climbing area that we use, that we developed. Nobody else uses it. It's not high enough for the people that are into large climbs, and it's kind of hidden for those that are simply out scouting around and having a good time. And so we've developed it for the program there at camp. And each of the climbs that we use to offer a certificate to the campers has been rated. One climb is called Bullwinkle because it has a great big nose of rock that sticks out like a moose, and you have to climb up underneath it and kind of go over a little bit backwards along a crack. Another climb is called Open Book because it's just a dihedral, which is a corner in the rock, and the walls come out almost not smooth, but with very small projections on both sides, and you climb it like you're climbing the inside of a book. The hardest climb that we have rated is not the most difficult climb in the area, but the hardest one that we use is called Muster Buster, because you burn out before you ever get to the top. It has a series of moves, and each move is harder than the last, and one of the hardest moves is right at the top. And so we rate those, and then the other climbs, if somebody asks us what it's rated, we'll tell them, but they're easier climbs. Do you know what climbs are the most desired? The hardest climbs. Everybody starts out and practices and learns a little bit of the movement and the balance on the easier climbs, but what they want is they want the certificate. They want to climb the highest number that they can possibly get to the top. And climbing Muster Buster has been climbed by one camper, I think, when they were a camper in camp itself, possibly two, maybe 2 years back. Because one of the campers is now on my staff, and he's better than all the rest of us almost. He's just a remarkable climber and has developed very, very well. On the front of the United Youth Camp magazine this year is a picture of our rappel station. Every year, somewhere in our literature, there will be a picture of somebody with the Tetons in the background and them back on a rock with all open airspace around them hanging on a rope on our rappel. And the reason that picture is retaken every year with somebody new and constantly republished in our literature is because it really makes it look like that camper is hanging on that rock right out there in the air, hundreds of feet off the valley floor. And the valley floor is indeed hundreds of feet below, but the rappel station itself is probably only 60 feet, maybe 50, 60 feet. Why not just shoot the picture of the camper on the ground? In fact, why not just stay on the ground to begin with? Because that's not where the desire is placed. That's not where accomplishment is attained. Life looks different when you have faced and conquered your fears. It looks different. When you build the confidence having overcome trial and test, then the next trial and test is not as dramatic as before. When Louise was there laying in the hospital bed, at times struggling in the pain, it made in her mind what Christ went through on her behalf a little more realistic, because she took and related her pain to the pain of Jesus Christ. He took his stripes on her behalf, and she consciously focused on that where she was there in that bed. Now, laying in that bed and suffering could have made her angry or sad. You see, a trial can go either way. A trial can encourage self-will, or it can promote humility. It obviously, as Christ is the finisher of our faith, would promote humility and selflessness in us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse number 3, Paul here writing to the Corinthians, and he says, Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort which we ourselves are comforted by God. Do you understand what that says? It says God is our comforter. He comforts us in tribulation with the comfort that we ourselves are comforted by God. And it says that we then comfort others who are in trouble. We pass that lesson on. If you haven't been there, it's hard to stop and explain it to someone else. Can you imagine someone saying, well, tell me what Vienna's like? Well, it's interesting. It's popular. What are you going to say? If you've been there, you can describe it. But if you've never been there, how well can you represent what that then represents and means? In a trial and test, when you've been there, you can teach someone else, but you can also have compassion. The faith that we have comes from God. It's not in us. Christ is the author of our faith. And so the courage and conviction we have in service to God that Christ is building in us is shared best only because we have walked through those trials and tests ourselves. Those things we face, brethren, are important. They're necessary. That's why James said, in that sense, even to rejoice in them, because you look past the issue itself to the value and the purpose to which we have been called. In 1 Peter chapter 4 is a passage that is similar to this. 1 Peter 4 and verse 12. It says, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing has happened. It's not like this is not intended to be part of our experience. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings. Now, I thought a lot this week about what Louise said as she laid there in that bed. Now, I can't talk to Jean because she's on a ventilator, and she's out because of the ventilator, and her circumstance is a little different. And so Perry and Gail and Kelly and Sue and I have all sat around and discussed various circumstances from our experiences and our lives and shared in that way. But when Louise was laying there and I watched her squirming in that bed and she says, well, Christ also suffered. And I thought, isn't that incredible? It says here, rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. The point being is, if indeed we learn the lesson Christ learned, then there is benefit to us, and this is not for loss. That we climb the hardest climb because we want to attain the highest possible goal and accomplishment. When I climbed the Grand Teton, well, it took me a while the first time because I was hurting so bad. It took me a while to think about that again, but you know what your mind starts to say? Well, that one was like 13,700 or some odd feet. It'd be nice to climb something that was over 14,000 feet. You begin to expand your goal and say, well, I can go a little further than that. I made that. I can try more. There are things in this life that I don't even consider to be trials that at one point in the past would have been very vexing to me. I simply don't consider them an issue at all. I've been there before. I know what that's like. It's okay. It's okay. The focus of what God has called us to relates very much to personal growth and our development, not just in good times, but very much also in bad. Don't think it's strange. You know, a fiery trial. When I heard a sermonette years ago when we were in Boise, and the man who got up to give it says, you know, if we were to pick our trials, we'd pick a trial that was difficult, challenging, stressed us, but not too much. We'd pick a trial that would kind of test our mettle, but then something we were confident we could see our way through. What kind of trials do you think God needs us to walk through? He needs us to walk through a trial that we're not going to say, I think I see how I can get through this just fine. No, He wants to see us come to God and say, God, help me. Please help me. I am relying on You. I can't make it without You. It takes a whole different kind of trial and test. Because what God wants is more in that sense sometimes than what we want. He simply wants more because He's going to give us the kingdom of God. Eternity with the power of His Spirit being in His family. There was a debate in the church a few years back over what our corporate focus should be. And one group said our focus should be a warning message to the world. And they were seriously concerned that the church was getting sidetracked by putting too much focus on the growth and development of the local congregation. And so there was a contest in the church and a dispute and a debate over those issues. And Matthew 24 was put forward as an example of what some of these individuals felt that our focus should be. Matthew 24:14. We know where it came from because we know what, in part, our historical perspective has been. But I believe in that sense, even our historical perspective was not clearly presented in this disagreement as it was. But Matthew 24:14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. And so they felt that the focus of our church should be a warning witness message to the world, and that focus on the local congregation in any undue way would be deficient. And it would cause that warning message not simply go forth as powerfully as it should. Now, it came across to me that they felt that congregations were almost a side benefit to the preaching of the gospel. That you focus on the witness, but that the forming of a congregation and the care and the nurture of a congregation, and quite frankly, the committing of assets and resources to a congregation, was not a direct purpose. Matthew 24 is a description of what is indeed going to happen. Now, that happened in part, possibly under Mr. Armstrong's leadership. I say possibly, obviously under Mr. Armstrong's leadership. But I don't know that it was complete. I know it will be complete, at least by the two witnesses, because their message will go to all the world, and I am not a prophet to where I can say, and by God's own word, exactly where the line on that was complete, and who did how much. Matthew 24 is not a job description for the church. It is a prophetic description of what is going to happen in the end time. The commission of the church is in Matthew 28. And here's where this argument was put back and forth. It's not Matthew 28 or Matthew 24. It's Matthew 28 and Matthew 24. But specifically, the commission of the church is spelled out in Matthew 28. And it gives a different focus. Warning message? Sure, there's a warning message. Preach the gospel? We're trying to preach the gospel. We're trying to expand the good news. We're publishing booklets as fast as we can get them out. We're trying to do that. But what is indeed in the midst of the commission the focus of the church? Is it just a warning, or is it something else? Matthew 28, verse 16. This is very end of the book of Matthew. This is the last thing recorded in this particular text. Christ has been resurrected. He's here working with the disciples. Then the 11 disciples went away to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. And when they saw Him, they worshipped Him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, final message of this text. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations. Now, warning them alone is not making disciples. Warning them is whether you respond or don't. But this goes specifically to make effort to make disciples of all the nations, obviously by God's power and by His calling, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. And so, there is a gospel message to be preached, but central to it is a high focus on the formation of the church congregation, on the maintenance of the church congregation as a body of people serving God together in their calling, being baptized, and then being taught to observe all these things. The nurture of those God calls is fundamental to the commission of the church. The need to be able to have Christ as the captain of our salvation and the author and the finisher of our faith. God is working with His family. Who in the world would just go out there and pretend to make babies when indeed God gave us a family so that we would take the children He grants us and raise them moment by moment into His care? Not just go out and talk about a family, but to actually raise one is what God gave us to do. Look at the spring holy days. Do the spring holy days portray a warning witness only, or do they portray the active development of the family of God? The first fruits are the church. The latter harvest is what comes later, but we're not portraying just a warning witness, we're portraying a church, a body, being called of God. We are what God is doing. John 21, a passage that reinforces this again. Here we are now at the very tail end of the book of John. And we have another account here about what the focus is, what the last part of the record is going to show. You know, sometimes before I leave home, if I'm heading on a trip or I'm out for a couple of days, and you'll stop and I'll talk to Michelle and I'll talk to Megan and Derek. What do you say? Be a good boy, be a good girl, honey, I love you. You know, you give the kids the kisses and all the bedtime ritual in advance, and you walk through, you tell them the last thing that you want to make sure they remember that you have to say. And so here you have another account in the Gospels with the very final comments that are tucked in John 21, starting in verse number 15. When he had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" He asks him if he has agape, godly love for him, more than these. And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he answers, phileo, or brotherly love. He came back a step in the word that he used and said, "Well, yes, I love you as a brother." And he said to him, "Feed my lambs." Is that warn them or care for them? Feed my lambs. And he said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Same word, agape. And he said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Same word, phileo. And he said, "Tend my sheep." Feed the lambs. Tend the sheep. These are his final instructions that are recorded in this passage. The message is here for a purpose. The same as there was previously in Matthew. And he said to him the third time, and he says, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Phileo. Christ now says, "Well, do you just love me as a brother?" And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." We are, brethren, what God is doing. Is there a warning message that needs to go out? Of course there is a warning message that needs to go out. But it is not just a warning message. The instruction to the church was to baptize, to teach, to nurture, to build the congregation, to have elders and deacons there to serve and care for the people, to teach and help the people to have faith, and that Christ would be finishing their faith, walking them through trials and circumstances and blessings as well to develop that character, because we are what God is doing. It is not some concept out somewhere else that all the resources are directed into that maybe bears fruit and maybe doesn't. Because God's words do not come back to Him empty, and we are not just doing something else. We are what God is doing. Christ is our captain, and He is bringing us to Him. I believe, and I know some of us have discussed some of these things, but I believe the church is going through a period of trial and test right now. And I don't mean just because of age and infirmity. Brother, nobody ever died of being well. Everyone gets old and die, and you don't die of being well. So I'm not just speaking of the fact that there's infirmity in the church. I've tried to describe this to various people, and the way I describe it, I says, everybody has a button, and it will be pushed. What is it that it can offend you? What is it that can cause you to turn back? Instead of laying there in the trial and rejoicing in the fact that Christ also suffered, what is it that would cause you to become angry or bitter or depressed or sad? Because we all have a button that's almost like it would be obvious if we could see it out there for what it represents. And it will be pushed. Because Christ is the finisher of our faith. Christ doesn't even need to push it. But it will be pushed. We must have the character in order to be a part of the family of God. And there's only one way to get there, and part of that way is through trial and test. In the book of James, I almost felt embarrassed to turn to this scripture, and in fact, I left it out a couple times. And I went back and I thought, well, I can't leave it all out. I really do want to add that, and so I'm going to leave out James 1, verse 2. And just read verse 3 and 4, and maybe it'll sound a little different without verse 2 that we commonly read into it. But it says, know that the testing of your faith produces patience. Know that the testing of your faith produces patience. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Every morning when I get up, except for Sabbath, holy days, or Monday through Friday, I try every morning when I get up to do push-ups. And if I do those push-ups, I don't have to go to the chiropractor. And if I don't do those push-ups, then sooner or later, I have a nerve that somehow begins to get pinched in my back. And so when I get up in the morning and I'm tired and I don't feel like it and push, I'm old enough now to where I actually can't do as many push-ups as I did last year. Now that's not fair, but that's how this works. I can do as many total, but I have to do them in smaller sets and stack them up. I can't just bust through without just a huge amount of effort to get up to that level of condition. But I have to do those, and yet sometimes I don't. And so then I began to, well, how can I keep track of how honest I am being willing to do what I know I must? And so I wrote a chart out, and I write down every single day exactly what I did. And then every day I miss, I draw a circle, and I count the days next to it so that I'll actually look on there and say, well, if it's a 1, that's okay, that's the Sabbath. If it's a 2, well, that's not bad, there was a holy day. But I got a 4 on there one week, and I'm going, what was I thinking? You know, do I want to be back on the bed again, laying there for a couple of days, waiting for the swelling to go down? working out in a trial is necessary for our spiritual health. It's necessary. Not because we like it or want to do it, we have to do it. It's for our good. And that's what James is talking about. Know that the testing of your faith works patience. Know that there has to be a spiritual workout to get where it is you want to go. We need to be able to focus inwardly on what God has called us to do and still be the example outwardly God has called us to represent. Members of the Church of God have liked, to a various degree, the outward focus. And by that, I mean looking out at the world. If I give a sermon on moral failure, it will be well received. Now, that's part of what God records and shows, and I can prove it, and we agree. So, in that sense, it's easy to agree to. But it's not enough, again, this witness to the world. The world is failing. Society is upside down. Society is not responsible in serving before God. That's not enough, brethren. Because what God is doing is us. And the faith that Christ is finishing is our faith. And it's we who must be strengthened. Members of the Church of God have generally been rather passionate news buffs, have we not? We listen to the news. We make sure we listen to the news. We read about the news. We discuss the news passionately at times, I think. You see, we were going to warn the world of the trouble to come, and then we were also going to keep close track of the world events, and effectively, we would watch it happen. We would watch prophecy play out. Matthew 24 described the warning of all these things that would take place, and Matthew 25 then described the watching. And we used to talk about watching as watching world events, watching for the beast power, watching for the rise of the Antichrist, the man of sin. Watch the Middle East. And so we would. We would pore over news and listen and focus very highly on that. Is that what we were supposed to watch? Matthew 25. In the context of the witness and the warning of Matthew 24. Matthew 25, the context follows right on over. What is the passage, the intent of the passage, the first part of Matthew 25? It's the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins. Who does that represent? The church. It represents God's people. They are all virgins. And so the whole beginning of this story is talking about the church. Some are awake, or they all slept. Some woke up. Some didn't have enough oil. And so the example has nothing to do fundamentally with the world or with prophetic events in the world, but with the church. And then notice in verse number 13, watch therefore, for you do not know the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. And so what do? We say, okay, we want to keep track of when the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, is returning. So we start to watch world events. And we want to see what happens in armies around Jerusalem. And we want to see what happens in trade alliances and nations and the moral deterioration of this nation and others who are brother nations to us. The watch, therefore, is in the very direct context of the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins. And so it's not, in that sense, primarily talking about reading and watching prophecy play out in the signs of the times in the Gentile nations of the world, or in the Israelite nations that have turned and not remained faithful to God. But it is talking about watching. Now, I'm not saying we don't watch world events. That's not my point. My point is, the focus of this passage is not somewhere else. It's not on Channel 6 on the news. There's a passage in Matthew 24 that says the very same basic thing, because these two chapters follow and flow very closely together. So go back to Matthew 24 and look at verse, in this case, I'd like to start in verse 36. Of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Okay, now Matthew 25 said, watch therefore, you know neither the day nor the hour. So we're talking about the exact same issue here. Verse 36, Matthew 24, but of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. As the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be, for as in the days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. So it describes a chaos in society, a walking away from obedience to God. Two men will be in the field, one's taken, another left. Two men will be grinding at the mill, one taken, another left. Life will carry on, and then it will cease. Notice this, though. Verse 42. Watch, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. So we think, okay, if the thief was coming at 4 and we could watch him walking down the road, then we'd go lock the door and make sure he couldn't come in and take our things. Verse 44. I'm not saying that doesn't exist and that isn't a facet, but here is the part that drives it home to us. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect him. He is coming and you need to be ready. The point is that our faith must be finished. Our faith must be complete. That we don't need to worry as much about events in Jerusalem as we do need to worry about the events right here in our own place, in our own mind, in our own home. Should we watch Jerusalem? I think we should. Should we be concerned about prophecy? I think we should. God wrote prophecy, and he wrote it for a purpose. But we should be more concerned about the church. We should be more concerned about our own congregation, about our own family, and about our own service and our calling to God. That's where our ultimate focus should be. Not out there somewhere else. That's an accessory thing. We must take what God has given us, and as we are older, you know, it's amazing to me, in this circuit, our attendance is slightly dropping in terms of being able to come to church because there are more of our elderly that are staying home. But the offerings are going up, and we see that with United. Now, the Passover took a big jump this year, and that is exciting. That was almost something like a 10% jump in a Passover attendance. And so fruit is born in a lot of ways, but brethren, we're older, we're weaker, we're tireder, and more is being done than there was when we were younger and fresher and more refreshed. By the power of God, more is being done. Sometimes God actually reduces our options so that we can become more fruitful before him, because in the process we will trust him more and we will trust ourselves less. Sometimes, brethren, our progress in this accomplishment of our faith being finished by Christ is measured more by what we do with our losses than by how we handle our gains. I want to read you something. John Gould just sent this to me yesterday, and in fact, I may have even pulled it off this morning. And I read it, and I thought it was interesting because it was so close to what I wanted to try to express on overcoming and still serving God according to the calling that we have received. This is a news article that came out of the Houston Chronicle, February the 10th of this year, by Jack Reamer, who's the author of it. It says, on November the 18th, 1995, Itzhak Perelman, the violinist, came on stage to give a concert at Lincoln Center in New York City. He said, if you've ever been to a Perelman concert, you know that getting on stage is no small achievement for him. He was stricken with polio as a child. He has braces on both legs and walks with the aid of two crutches. You see him walk across the stage a step at a time, painfully and slowly. That's an awesome sight. He walks and he reaches his chair. He sits down slowly, puts his crutches on the floor, undoes the clasps on his legs, tucks one foot back and extends the other foot forward, bends down, picks up the violin, puts it under his chin, nods to the conductor, and proceeds to play. He says the audience is used to the ritual because they understand what his limitations physically are. And they sit quietly as he makes his way across the stage. They sit reverently silent as he undoes the clasps on his legs. They wait till he's ready to play, but this time something went wrong. Just as he finished the first few bars, one of the strings on his violin broke. You could hear it snap. It went off like gunfire across the room. There was no mistaking what the sound meant, and there was no mistaking what he had to do. People who were there that night thought, well, we figured he'd just have to get up, put on the braces again, pick up the crutches, limp his way off stage, find either another violin or another string for this one. But he didn't. Instead, he waited a moment, closed his eyes, and then signaled the conductor to begin again. The orchestra began. He played from where he had left off. He played with such passion and such power and purity as they had never heard before. Of course, anyone knows it's impossible to play a symphonic work with just three strings. I know that, and you know that, but that night, Itzhak Perelman refused to know that. You could see him modulating, changing, recomposing the piece in his head. At one point, it sounded like he was detuning the strings to get sounds from them that they had never made before. When he finished, there was an awesome silence in the room, and then people rose and cheered. There was an extraordinary outburst of applause from every corner of the auditorium. We were all on our feet, screaming and cheering, doing everything we could to show how much we appreciated what he had done, because he did more with less. And the crowd themselves was inspired at the accomplishment. He smiled, wiped the sweat from his brow, raised his bow to quiet us, and then he said, not boastfully, but in a quiet, pensive, reverent tone, you know, sometimes it is the artist's task to find out how much music you can still make with what you have left. What a powerful line that is. It stayed in my mind ever since I heard it, and who knows? Perhaps that is the definition of life, not just for artists, but for all of us. Here is a man who has prepared all his life to make music on a violin of four strings, who all of a sudden, in the middle of a concert, finds himself with only three strings. So he makes music with three strings, and the music he made that night with just three strings was more beautiful, more sacred, more memorable than any that he had ever made before when he had four strings. So perhaps our task in this shaky, fast-changing, bewildering world in which we live is to make music, at first with all that we have, and then when that is no longer possible, to make music with what we have left. Who here, who has age and years of service to God and the church, still has the strength they used to have, the eyes you used to have, the means and ability and the energy and the patience you used to have? Well, you know, maybe it's the patience that actually has increased. And how did we get it? By waiting, by serving, by responding to God's call, by exercising the faith that He gave us, and by letting Christ, who is the author and the finisher of our faith, to work with us so that we might profit to Him in preparation for the kingdom of God. Let us never begrudge that process, brethren. Rather, let us be very careful to rejoice in the calling that we have received.